This week, we are joined by Dr. Emma Patu for a conversation about how fiat money systems destroy the incentives for governments to deliver public services effectively and the socioeconomic problems that stem from that systemic issue as a result. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how we'll help them. If you're interested how Bitcoin solves the problem of the effectiveness of public spending and the delivery of public programs, stick around. This one was a lot of fun. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward Podcast. This week we are joined by special guest Emma Patu. Emma, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So for our listeners, I always love to just start with a quick TLDR for the guests. Can you just tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe like how you got started in Bitcoin?
Yeah, sure. So I wear, I would say, two major hats. The first one being I'm an associate professor at McMaster University, and I specialize in the social determinants of health, specifically in the area of health promotion. So that really is about just supporting people with the education and knowledge that's needed to live a healthy life. And the other hat that I wear is in the Bitcoin space. And I recently launched DreamGrad Academy this year. And it's an educational platform and consultancy helping individuals and businesses, organizations understand what Bitcoin is. So for the Bitcoin, you know, curious person that's heard about it, kind of want to learn more about it for themselves and how they can use it to serve others. And I've partnered with BitcoinMentor.io, which is a great educational company headed by BTC Sessions and Mike Cook. And we have a whole team that's equipped to help people along the beginnings of their Bitcoin education journey to, you know, the Bitcoiner that wants to just enhance their Bitcoin setup. How did I get into Bitcoin? It's interesting. I was listening to, I think you had Caribou on one of your previous episodes. And I think it was maybe around 2021 that it's the idea of Bitcoin kind of cemented for him. And that was same thing for me. And I think a lot of people too, kind of that pandemic time. And it's really interesting when I was listening to his podcast, he kind of came up with this revelation of, I think it was the cake layer theory. And notice that kind of that socioeconomic layer is probably one of the most important levers that you can use to address health. In his case, he's, I believe, a physical therapist, and he was noticing that he was addressing symptoms and rather than, you know, actually root causes. And for myself in public health, I came up to a similar realization that in many ways we're addressing symptoms and not the root causes. And particularly for me at this time, there is a lot of discussion around socioeconomic inequalities and the need for paid sick leave. And this really impacted those that were on the lower rungs of the socioeconomic scale. And it just made me think immediately of this health promotion theory known as the Friedman Pyramid. And at the base layer is a socioeconomic layer, and that's where you can make the biggest impact to address inequality. And if you move further up, you have clinical care and then like counseling education. That's where you can make an impact, but not as much of a greater impact. And so for me, it just kind of, I was like, okay, so how can we really, you know, address the cracks in the foundations here? And it led me to Bitcoin. And yeah, ever since then, I was like, I just want to, again, promote the idea. I mean, that's what health promotion is all about. And I feel like it's an idea that hasn't fully reached the healthcare and public health space. And I just hope that the idea can spread even more.
It's such an interesting aspect of Bitcoin, how really it, anyone, once they've understood Bitcoin, can relate it then to their own like personal interests or professional career. Like Bitcoin is this crazy thing that has an application in everything, because money and the problems of broken money are so hopelessly intertwined in every aspect of our society. And so, yeah, the healthcare one is of interest for me, because I kind of have worked in health insurance for most of my career. Yeah, I, you know, the pyramid of needs has me thinking about how, like, it's equally true financially that the people who are sort of at the bottom of the pyramid are the ones that are most, you know, just affected in standard of living as money breaks further and further. It's, you know, people who own assets tend to enjoy the benefits of inflation as those prices of assets increase, and it penalizes the people who are really stuck living paycheck to paycheck. And I think, you know, as I listen to you, this, it's very analogous to problems of healthcare, which is is kind of an interesting entry point into how does Bitcoin, you know, how does Bitcoin help this problem?
Yeah, I think it can help in many ways. Like at the individual level, I think it empowers people to find out the best solutions for themselves. You know, a lot of scientific data draws from group data, and which I think it is definitely a good starting point. It can help you allocate funds to, you know, to some respect for program planning purposes. But, you know, some of these kind of group programs, you know, miss on the individual level. And so I think having an asset that can allow you to explore maybe, you know, alternative solutions, I think is important. And having more like alternative carers, providers that accept Bitcoin as well too, that can help them thrive as well, offer more services. So I think it serves as this individual kind of empowerment tool. I think at the community level, it can help to create a circular resource that can then address social determinants of health, that can then help lifestyle factors that could prevent a lot of disease. And I think if you have empowered individuals, you can then have empowered communities as well. And I think along with that, you know, communities as well could become more decentralized and may not have to rely on centralized pools of funding so much. And then I think at the systems level, you know, in Canada, we spend over $300 billion on healthcare, and a large share of that goes towards funding hospitals, drugs, and lastly, physicians. That's kind of the main buckets that we spend in. And I think, you know, over the years, we've had a lot of like physician shortages, clinical shortages of, you know, people that serve as providers. And so I think there could be potentially some misallocations of funds there. And so maybe with a Bitcoin standard, we can more transparently see where needs are to properly allocate and meet the needs individuals and also communities as well. You know, it's very interesting. You've probably seen that website. I think it's www.whatthefhappened in 1971. And in that website, you could see like a lot of like social, you know, indicators are just on a downward trend. And an interesting thing that I don't think we talk a lot about, especially in Canada, is that, you know, we kind of have this hybrid funding system in healthcare. So we have federal funds that, you know, the provinces are given some monies, and then the provinces have to generate funds. And so in the 1970s, provinces would get approximately about 35% of funding from the federal government through these transfers. And ever since then, that funding has gone down. And now, for example, I think in the province of Ontario, we get about 22%. So, you know, imagine looking 10 years out from now, like how much funding are we going to get, you know, federally? And, you know, I really think that, again, healthcare will become more decentralized. So I think provinces now should be thinking about, maybe if we have a Bitcoin standard at the provincial level, maybe this might help us think about our funding models and prepare for this potential shortfall. So I think Bitcoin can really impact health on so many levels.
Yeah, there's a, I think you phrase it very delicately, and I'll give you some kudos. And maybe I'd have to be less delicate and just say that the government has no incentive to be spending their money effectively when there is an infinite money printer to create money endlessly. And this is just a fundamental flaw with not only does the money, can the money be created endlessly, but there's no sort of control mechanism to audit how the collection of that money can grow over time and then how that money is spent. So there are sort of like multiple points of failure working against the healthcare system to create, you know, effective outcomes. And it's a huge problem. I think that another thing, this is going back to a previous point you made, but about what happened in 1971, because I think that we have really seen a rapid acceleration of sort of unraveling of different social cohesion. And like the one stat that sticks out to me is the divorce rate. If you overlay inflation since 1971 and divorces, the charts look spookily similar. And there is a direct correlation between financial stress. Like, I think financial stress is the number one cause of marriages ending. And then you have, you know, single parent families and parents that have to find childcare options because they have to work two jobs now. And like, there are all these secondary effects that happened as a result of this sort of one decision that happened. It didn't even happen in our country. Like, you know, you're in Canada as well, right? And it's crazy. I think that, but our public spending model here is a really sort of like not uniquely Canadian thing, but we do have a very ingrained sense that public spending sort of will increase indefinitely forever. And I think that, it's created a different kind of problem that I don't mind to throw my two cents in, where it's free in the sense that you don't have to pay for individual access when you go to do stuff within the healthcare system. But the quality of the delivery is experiencing challenges to various degrees across the country. Yeah, personal story, my fiance had to access the private healthcare system in the US earlier this year, and we had like an incredible, you know, so there was a fee attached to a small procedure, but like we were able to accomplish what would have taken years in Canada in a matter of weeks. And, you know, it's not free because we all do indirectly through taxation pay for these services.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, again, if we think of the early 1910s, right, it really shifted the way in which medical care was delivered. Prior to that time, medical care was a lot more decentralized, a lot more fee-for-service, and particularly also more so in the U.S., I would say. But I think there's definitely some problems in our Canadian system. Like the Canadian Medical Association, you know, in their recent reports talk about, you know, the excessive, you know, surgical backlogs that they have, overcrowded, you know, emergency rooms, just chronic underfunding in several areas to support care. And it always comes back to this, you know, we need more funding, but if the money is broken and inflationary, you're just going to continue the same problems over and over. And that's one of the things that I kind of got kind of frustrated about. Like, I'm not a clinician. I am an interdisciplinary public health educator, if you will. And so I've dabbled in like a bunch of different like health related topics. And you kind of just start seeing the same problems over and over. You know, again, the economic inequalities are kind of talking about in the beginning, healthcare underutilization due to just chronic underfunding, all of these things. And just, you know, in the peer reviewed literature, you know, the discussion section, you're supposed to like, you know, bring home some enlightening, you know, points around your findings. And it's usually something that someone has already previously said about, oh, we need more money. And so I think that frustration was like in my mind, and it's just like, we need to find another way. And, you know, at first I was like, there's no way it could be Bitcoin, you know, as this like kind of financial solution. But when you realize that Bitcoin is really solving for better money, a better monetary system, you're like, whoa, like we could be building a parallel system. Like, to bring Caribou up again, like I really appreciate his work around these like open health protocols. And I think that's a fantastic example of a potential solution where we could, you know, again, decentralize the way or empower that individual who's, you know, trying to seek good information, they can stumble across, you know, something that's very well vetted, and they could also vet it for themselves and test the solutions. Like, we are our own best, you know, use cases, right? And so I just think the solutions that we're going to see on a Bitcoin standard, I think, is going to be incredible. And the things that are happening right now, like, I'm really excited about.
Absolutely. So how do you go about, you know, these are sort of like, anytime you try to introduce an idea, you know, Bitcoin can be, is a tricky one on its own, but in a very sort of like fiat minded system like healthcare, how does the Bitcoin conversation, like, where do you even start?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've done a couple kind of like academic talks, and some to, like, you know, traditionally trained economists. And, you know, I get the arguments that, you know, deflation would be terrible. Well, yes, it would be terrible in an inflationary credit-based system. Yeah, that means, you know, the system would collapse. So I can agree with you there. But at the same time, like, deflation is, you know, many of us Bitcoiners have read like Jeff Booth's book, and, you know, deflation isn't a bad thing, right? It is harnessing what technology is supposed to be giving us. And I just appreciate to also hear your thoughts on the idea of deflation and some of your arguments for it, because that is actually one of the big pushbacks that I get. And I try and, you know, kind of point them to the Jeff Booth books. But I know this podcast will go out widely, so if you have any additional points there. But it, admittedly, getting the case of Bitcoin to the academic crowd has been a bit difficult.
Yeah, we did a really cool episode right around when the Caribou episode happened with Ivan Makadonsky from Breeze. And that episode is called Addicted to Digits. So if anyone's listening and is interested, I completely agree. Ivan has this really cool idea, essentially, that, you know, everyone has sort of like this a dopamine addiction that results from like seeing numbers grow. And part of the problem with the conversation around, so there's two problems. One problem with deflation is, yeah, as you pointed out, deflation occurring inside an inflationary system is going to be a really painful event. And unfortunately, I think that that event is inevitable. This is kind of like a Greg Foss thing. You know, it's a 100% certainty. And I'm a big fan of an economic school called Long Waves, which came out of the Soviet Russia, early Soviet Russia, and a fellow named Kondratiev. And this is a study of 60-year elongated patterns of credit bubbles and asset prices. And essentially, it doesn't matter. We got lots of data going back hundreds of years about inflation and deflation related to technology. And Jeff doesn't talk about it in this book, but Kondratiev sort of explains that, yeah, there is an inexorable link between, you know, sort of risk builds up in the system as credit becomes cheaper. And then at a certain point, these bubbles pop, assets become overpriced, and then a technological change will drive a new sort of like cost of creating stuff that should be less. So that was the Industrial Revolution. That was the locomotive and assembly line manufacturing. You know, we're kind of like heading into another one of these times, probably with AI. And I think, like, Canada in particular, we have the highest household debt to GDP. Our assets have just become sort of hyper-financialized. And people, this is the other half of the deflation problem, is back to addicted to digits with Ivan, is that in some ways, the inflation of assets like real estate in Canada have actually made people rich. So people have flipped houses or, you know, sort of cashed out and moved to Costa Rica, and that house did, you know, they were able to trade those Canadian dollars that they made in our inflating real estate market for US dollars, and those US dollars were then turned into a beachfront property in Costa Rica. That's real. So it's hard to argue that people would think they're getting rich as these numbers are growing, but this is that big disconnect, is the idea that the numbers going up are just, they're doing two things. They're depleting our dopamine and making us addicted to bigger numbers, but they're also really hollowing out the financial system and making the us all poor, just starting at the bottom of the pyramid. So I guess that was a super long answer to a short question, but yeah, I'm a big deflation person. I think that we are headed for a systemic repricing of a number of assets in Canada and in asset classes. And the real reason why I'm so passionate about Bitcoin, especially for Canadians, is that I think it's just about the only thing that's going to be safe as the Canadian dollar really starts to wobble. It seems like it's probably an inevitability at this point.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think that I do agree with you that there probably is a repricing coming. So another kind of mental roadblock that I get with some of the, especially those traditional economists, is sticky prices and wages. And, you know, like I kind of use the argument, you know, house prices are going up, wages, you know, are kind of flat. But essentially the argument, well, it'll take time for, you know, wages to go up. But it just seems like this just persistent kind of inflation in assets. I think that's a reflection of, you know, the money printer going brr. But again, there's kind of that pushback because of all of these kind of like theories, you know, the sticky prices, wages theories, and optimal currency zones as well as another one that I get as well too, that, you know, these are set up to stabilize but, you know, there's so many arguments against that. Like, is it fair that, you know, you have several countries in Africa where, you know, France is setting the, you know, kind of the exchange, you know, for their local currencies? Like, so there's a lot of these like mental frameworks that I find a lot of people get stuck in, and this doesn't allow them to see, you know, the potential fix that Bitcoin, but actually it may not be a fix. Like, it is kind of just over here working in a different, you know, system. And so it's just like people just maybe need to see that, oh, okay, there's a different, totally different, you know, paradigm being established. And the theories that I know are probably not going to, you know, hold water in this new system.
Yeah, I mean, I do think it's affecting change. One of my favorite safety in quotes is you can ignore hard money, but you can't ignore the effects of hard money. This is something that's like totally happening right now, I think, as you see Brazil has announced that they're considering a national Bitcoin strategic reserve. And they're just the kinds of announcements like this are now happening just about every day, where a big company or the state of Pennsylvania, like we're really starting to see, I think, a lot of people, you know. At some point, the broken money becomes a problem that's just so prevalent that I think the conversation alone has started to just generate a lot of momentum. Like, people are just talking about Bitcoin. So yeah, we'll see. You mentioned Africa, and because I have seen you in your travels, you also have some insights about how these problems in healthcare maybe are more pronounced in these countries where the money is even more broken.
I would say, especially probably in the area of like global health, like there is this kind of Western view that, for example, like Africa needs help. But, you know, I think there's a lot of, you know, voices out there that would say that Africa needs trade. You know, there's been just so many, you know, barriers to trade, you know, due to, you know, currency debasement. And when you have all of that, like, how can you, you know, talking about base layer again, how can you build a strong healthcare system on top of a crumbling financial system? So yeah, it's in many ways, and we need to think about this because this will impact us globally, because, you know, Africa has a great majority of young people, you know, in our world. And so, you know, if you are kind of someone that thinks globally, you know, we need to think about how are we setting up our global systems. And I think the whole financial setup that we have internationally, again, I think that needs to be reframed and, you know, think about this whole thing about aid, for example. Like, imagine if Africans were able to, it's lots of great innovation and care happening, but imagine what could be for that continent, you know, if they had a true economic system, they had sovereignty over their money. And I think Bitcoin is going to, again, help to decentralize, you know, systems that have just been so centralized and very broken, where you know, critical medical supplies haven't been able to, you know, get to the ground, if you will. I think we'll see hopefully some more good happening in Africa and around the world too.
Yeah. I mean, it's, I think that there's a direct parallel at the social level, at the individual level and the societal level. Same we were talking about earlier in the conversation about how it's the people at the bottom of the pyramid that are earliest and most affected by broken money. And this is also true for economic regions. Continents, you know, so Central America, Africa, Southeast parts of Southeast Asia, you know, I think these places that have historically just really had a difficult time having a money that works decently. These are the countries that have also ended up in on the wrong side of all of these predatory loans from the IMF and never ending cycle of having to hyperinflate their own currency to make payments on loans they can never pay back. And so, yeah, absolutely. I think when I think about the what's exciting about how Bitcoin can change the lives of individuals, it is absolutely just as true for large scale mass transformation of places that really just have been like both hands tied behind their back as far as making real progress as civilizations because they just can't figure this money problem out. And yeah, like you mentioned in Africa, there's also this, you know, berserk legacy situation where a number of them don't even issue their own currency. And so they get strip mined for natural resources out of something that it just has no reason existing today. And I think this is the thing about what's cool about Bitcoin. This is also a thing that's true for individuals and true for societies. You see this, I was in El Salvador a few weeks ago for adopting Bitcoin, and countries where the experience with money and broken money has been much worse, those are the people who are really ready just to explore technology, and just all they really want is a money system that seems to do what money's supposed to do. And I think in places like Canada, we see the price of houses rising and we complain about how much it costs to fill up the gas tank of your vehicle, but you still can't pay for a coffee at Tim Hortons with Bitcoin. So it feels like to the average person here that Bitcoin is not happening. And then you go to other parts in the world where the money was completely busted and there's just a lot more willingness to change and sort of like optimism around forging a brighter future with new tools.
Yeah, I want to shout out the Federation for Bitcoin Circular Economy. It's like the work that they're doing is great, like highlighting all of the great things that's happening around the world. And I'm just thinking I'm not sure where they are exactly in Africa, for example, but they have pharmacies that are accepting Bitcoin and mothers can get, you know, life-saving things for themselves, for their babies. And there are, you know, multiple examples of, you know, all these wonderful things that's happening on top of Bitcoin that are servicing people in health and, you know, deconstructing that legacy system, and communities are taking it upon themselves to come up with the solutions that they see fit.
Yeah, and I think, you know, for a lot of those places, the idea of being able to protect your wealth without having to physically protect it is also just kind of like this is enables another the next rung up of the bottom of the pyramid of like social cohesion, right? When all of a sudden people can sort of like safely store their time and energy and wealth without physically endangering their lives, then now all of a sudden you have a much more like fertile garden for people to like flourish and for real progress to happen. So yeah, it's I've been following, you know, like I'm not super into the tech part of Bitcoin, but I was really interested to see how in Africa they've developed this mechanism for exchanging Bitcoin just using analog phones it's so the human ingenuity with this stuff is just, it's mind-blowing. And I think the open source nature of it, like I mentioned, there's no limit to the problems that can be solved in this case because everyone is suffering from the same problem. So it's an amazing time to be alive.
I agree. And yeah, you know, Bitcoin is this lifeblood again. It's energetic, you know, it's an energetic thing, and it's just like putting life back into places where, you know, we need to be rejuvenated. Like our legacy system, it's anemic. It is, you know, it's on its last legs. And so just like, we are so fortunate to be living in a time where we have this, you know, alternative thing, because ultimately, you know, we want the things that money can buy. Like, do we necessarily want, you know, more money for the sake of it? You know, maybe some people, but, you know, most people want it to support their health, to support their families. And so just Bitcoin is just such a kind of life-saving force. And I think, you know, this conversation is kind of centered around health and healthcare. And I think, yeah, it's going to give us more oxygen.
Yeah. I mean, and just maybe to come back to that part about at the social level, to tie it back to healthcare, like when you have entire countries that can't functionally operate and deliver healthcare to people, like that, this is a massive limiting factor to social cohesion. And so intimately tied to money. So these problems can totally be fixed. And probably, you know, fix faster than I think people think is possible.
Yeah, I think so. Just like to your earlier points, like humans are ingenious. And I think we will just like iterate until we, you know, get to the right solutions. Just like look at the evolution of Bitcoin, right? Like we were, you know, in the early stages, people are like, how is this going to scale to billions of people? And I think we still have some of those questions today, but look at, you know, you have Lightning, you have all these other like, you know, tools on, you know, the other layers that will just support, you know, adoption. Is it going to be perfect moving forward? You know, there's going to be probably some bumps in the road, but I think we will figure it out.
Let's talk a little bit about the Academy and how that's going. So a little bit of an overview of what it is and how it works.
Yeah. So right now I'm really targeting just beginners once again. And so, for example, on LinkedIn, I would say semi-regularly, I host kind of like just Bitcoin kind of 101, like what is it? And, you know, there's approximately, I would say, depending 10 to maybe 20 people that register, and then a small group of that usually turns out to the actual kind of webinar. And sometimes it's really nice because then you get like that kind of like small group interaction to like really ask questions. Like I really, and this probably, you know, I am at McMaster, and so McMaster really pushes like the problem-based learning model. And I think this is great for Bitcoin, right? Because for many of us that come to Bitcoin, we see it solves a problem. And so I try and use that model to then help people see through their lens, like what Bitcoin is solving for, and especially in a way that they care about it. And so, yeah. And so those people then go on to, some people are like, oh, that's great. Not for me right now. I just don't want to dive in. But then you have some that were like really want more education. And so I work with them one-on-one. And then really the goal is to get people to that like self-custody like level. And that's where the partnership with Bitcoin Mentor comes in and helping those people along their journey. So yeah, I've worked with an organization for Network for Change. They had kind of these delegates that come from around the world and did an introductory session with them around, you know, what Bitcoin is. And so, yes, it's a growing, evolving, educational kind of community and platform.
Very cool. It's like a frontline care delivery of Bitcoin. Bitcoin services. So I wanted to ask you about how you find the Bitcoin conversation in universities or in a university. You're in a university. This is something that I'm interested in myself. I think that, you know, part of this confusion around the problem of money is, you know, actually I would say Bitcoin has a few aspects of it that become lightning rods for political conversations when the problem of money, in my opinion, is apolitical, and it equally affects, you know, if you're someone who identifies as sort of a left leaning person or a right leaning person, like we're all paying the same for apples when we go to the grocery store. So, but that's not necessarily how people see it, and especially I would say maybe on university campuses would be a demographic where that could skew. Like, how do you find the Bitcoin conversation on campus?
Yes. So admittedly, on the campuses that I step foot on, I really haven't found like a vibrant conversation around Bitcoin. Like I really want this to come from like the students. And so I've worked with, let's, for example, one student, we worked on this like scoping review to explore Bitcoin use cases in the peer-reviewed literature. And so, you know, you work with a student, they go on, they graduate. And so it's sometimes tough to get like that critical mass that you need. Also, I'm coordinating a course right now. It's like a capstone course. So a lot of these students, again, are going to go and graduate. And so, you know, they all know that I'm very passionate about this. And so I try not to try an orange pill every single session that we meet. But I think they do all know that, you know, I feel that money is probably one of the biggest kind of social determinant issues that we don't talk about so much. So unfortunately, really, I don't have a pulse on like the corners of the institution, like what those conversations are like. But I can just say that in some of the prevailing schools of maybe economics, it's a tough topic to really introduce, as I was kind of mentioning at the beginning. I think students are very, I know across Canada, we've had, I think Laurier has a Bitcoin club, Victoria. So there's definitely growing interest across Canada. I just think that in some local settings, there isn't just a full conversation yet, or maybe I'm just not aware.
Yeah, that part is amazing to me too, that like we could be this far along and there wouldn't be a Bitcoin club at every university. And but there isn't, as far as I understand. So yeah, fascinating. I wonder how I would be sometimes if I was that age and trying to keep track of Bitcoin at this juncture. I have like, yeah, who knows? I'd probably be not paying attention to it either. But
same, probably. I'd be so kind of like laser focused in like my kind of discipline area and be like, why do I need to know about this Bitcoin thing? I do think there is kind of interest in crypto from the student body perspective. And so, and also like fintech is a very big kind of like buzzword, but like kind of just interest in Bitcoin only. I'm not too sure, you know.
Yeah, it's a much deeper rabbit hole to get all the way to Bitcoin only. So I can't hold it against anyone who hasn't gotten there yet. That's why we have a podcast.
Exactly. And you're doing a great job.
Thanks. So for anyone who's listening and wants to find you online, where can we send them if they're looking to connect?
Yes, they can go to www.dreamgradacademy.com. They can also go to bitcoinmentor.io. I'm one of the mentors listed there. Dream Grad Academy also has an X presence as well. And if you may link the X link in the show notes, because I think there's a letter missing in the handle. It's like Dream GRD Academy.
Okay, cool. Yeah. Well, we'll include all those in the show notes. And thanks so much for coming on, Emma. This was a lot of fun, and really appreciate you and the work you're doing out in the Bitcoin community. And we didn't mention this, I guess, at the outset of the show. I got to meet you last year at the Montreal. I guess that was this year. The Bitcoin Canadian Bitcoin Conference in Montreal, and really enjoyed what you had to say. So yeah, it's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you so much.
And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you again next week.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and BMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.